Good morning. May it please the court. David Koch here on behalf of Mr. Courtney. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
Well.
As this court is aware, the Supreme Court has granted review in State v. Love, a case that factually is quite similar to Mr. Courtney's case in terms of the public trial and right to be present issues. And I suspect that whatever the Supreme Court decides in Love is either going to dictate the outcome in Mr. Courtney's case, or it's certainly going to show the path to the outcome. For that reason, it's my intention this morning to focus on the double jeopardy issue. Unless the court directs me otherwise, I'd be happy to address the other issues as well. Now, we're asking this court to find that the convictions for robbery in the second degree and assault in the third degree violate double jeopardy. And the interpretive tool that we're using to try to convince the court of our point is the merger doctrine. Now, this court's familiar with the doctrine. Typically, it comes into play when the degree of one offense is raised by conduct separately criminalized by the legislature. When that happens...
Is the merger doctrine different than a double jeopardy analysis?
It is part of a double jeopardy analysis.
So what is the test in Washington on the merger doctrine? Is it strictly the Blockberger test, or is it something else, the same evidence test, or some combination of
it? It's a combination, and I think the best case for laying it out, the analysis is State v. Freeman, where I believe it was Justice Chambers who went through and said, you know, step by step, you look and see if there's any express intent from the legislature. If not, you can use the Blockberger test. You can then move on to the merger test, and then there's exceptions to each of those, depending on what you find. So it's all part of double jeopardy analysis, and I think it really depends on the circumstances of the convictions you're talking about as to which is the best portion of that analysis to reveal legislative intent. Now, we're arguing that it's merger analysis. The state is arguing in response that really that should only apply to situations where you've got a degree of an offense that's being raised to a higher degree. But in fact, if you look, historically that's not been strictly true, and it's not true currently either. We've cited In re Butler back in 1979, where this court used the merger doctrine to say the defendant couldn't be convicted of both assault and rob two, where the assault was part and parcel of the robbery. Now, the state says Butler's an old case. It is, but it's never been overturned. And if this court's looking for a more recent example of the merger doctrine in sort of one of the less typical scenarios, then this court need look no further than State v. Davis, decided in 2013, which I've cited as supplemental authority. And I think really the circumstances of Davis are analogous to the circumstances of Mr. Courtney's case, even though it involves different crimes. Because in Davis, you had a defendant convicted of kidnapping in the second degree and intentional abduction. This was part of a repossession of a vehicle. And assault, too, based on the pointing of a gun at the individuals who had the vehicle. And the proof of the assault also established proof of the abduction. And this court found that, therefore, it elevated what would have been an unlawful imprisonment up to a kidnapping in the second degree. Now, I believe the state, it looks like in the opinion, the state made a similar argument there as they're making here, that, well, merger shouldn't apply because it's not like kidnapping two is elevated to kidnapping one. But this court recognized that it really was a similar situation, even though you didn't have that elevation of, you know, kidnapping two to kidnapping one, because it was unlawful imprisonment and kidnapping were almost like different degrees of the same offense. And in concluding that, this court noted they were in the same chapter, and in fact, unlawful imprisonment was a lesser included offense of kidnapping in the second degree. The same is true in Mr. Courtney's case. Here, the assaultive conduct that was charged as assault three was part of what elevated what would otherwise be a theft three to robbery two. In fact,
there were two counts of assault, one for
there
each
were.
Security person.
That's correct.
Okay. And with regard to the count that he was convicted on, there were two alleged acts. Is that correct? Acts of assault?
Only one alleged act, I believe, making contact with Mr. Duval's face when he was flailing around on the ground. I believe that's the act that they were focusing on.
Okay, and so then their argument is that occurred post robbery.
That is their argument.
Okay, and if we agree with that, then is there any assault what is the assault that increased that caused this the count he was convicted on to be a robbery? Which assault? Is there another assault?
Well, the assault they pointed to was the attempted battery,
okay.
Yes,
all
the swinging. And in our opinion, it's an artificial division. What they're saying is the swinging completed the robbery, and as soon as the bottles slipped out of Mr. Courtney's pants, anything thereafter could be an assault. Now, I assume, and maybe the state will correct me, but had the bottle stayed in Mr. Courtney's pants, then I guess the state's theory would have been they could have only charged him with robbery, because any force would still be used to maintain the bottles. But because they slipped out accidentally, somehow they can now charge him with robbery and two counts of assault. I realize he only went down on one. But it's kind of an odd thing to think the legislature would have intended that in these circumstances. And I say it's an artificial sort of separation of what happened, because I think you have to remember that, you know, this happened, you know, instantaneously. It was, you know, boom, boom in terms of the parking lot. This wasn't over the span of many minutes. In fact, during closing argument, the prosecutor said, this is RP 125, this thing happened in a span of movements, not several minutes.
And or if he'd picked up the bottles after they'd slipped out and the struggle continued. Then what?
Then it seems also consistent with a robbery, an ongoing robbery, that the force that he's using, while certainly trying to escape from the individuals, is done to maintain control of those bottles and escape with the bottles. But I think it's important in this case, although he wasn't able to grab the bottles again, every indication in this record is that Mr. Courtney's intention all along was to get away with those bottles. This is not like State v. Johnson, where you have the defendant clearly abandoning the property and then thereafter committing an assault.
Was there any evidence about whether or not Mr. Courtney knew or did not know that the bottles were in his possession?
He stuck them in his pants.
But at some point he lost them. I mean, was he aware that he lost them? Is there any evidence that we can?
You know, there isn't anything in the record about that. I mean, for all we know, he still believed they were in his pants. What the record tells us is that after he took the swing at the security guard, Mr. Duval apparently pushed him forward using his own momentum to get him down, and the bottle slipped out at that point. They didn't break, and they were somewhere close by. That's all we know. But instantly, Mr. Duval was on my client, and of course, the second guard also joined. So there's no indication that he even knew that the bottles had slipped out. But I think it's important to remember that, you know,
how are we to determine whether or not the second assault was in furtherance of the robbery? I mean, how?
Well, this court's review is de novo when we're talking about double jeopardy. So you don't owe deference to anyone. And I think it's a common sense, the only assessment of the evidence that really makes sense. And I go back to the fact that every indication here is that Mr. Courtney intended to keep these bottles and get away with them. He slipped them in his pants. When he first saw security after them, he didn't abandon them and try to run away. He held on to them. Even after the security guard caught up with him, he didn't, you know, throw the bottles to the side. He tried to punch the individual, and then he was immediately tackled. There's nothing to indicate that his intent ever changed, and that was an intent to get away, yes, but to get away with those bottles. And again, I distinguish what happened here from the situation in Johnson. It's nothing like that. So everything in this record is consistent with an intent to get away with those bottles. I think that's an important distinction. The other thing I'd point out is that when we're talking about double jeopardy, under the case law, whether it's State v. Keir, State v. Much, the defendant gets the benefit of the doubt if this court has any question. The rule of lenity side with him in terms of deciding how many offenses were committed. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll go ahead and reserve the rest of my time.
Very well.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kathleen Proctor from the Pierce County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, representing the state. We're here to ask this court to affirm the convictions below. I, too, will focus my arguments on the double jeopardy issue unless the court asks questions in other areas. A double jeopardy claim, although it's constitutional in base, essentially asks, what did the legislature intend? Did it intend to impose double punishments when two charges are brought in a single prosecution? And after Cali and subsequent cases, it's pretty clear that you go through a four-part analysis to assess whether the legislature intended to allow double punishments. The first is there express statutory authorization, like the burglary anti-merger doctrine? We don't have that here. The next is that you ask about the same evidence test, or the Blockberger test. Is there an element in each crime which is not in the other? And if you can answer that question yes, that is strong evidence that those are separate offenses and may be separately punished.
Does Washington strictly follow Blockberger, or do you look at the same evidence along with it?
It is essentially the same test. They call it the same evidence test. Is it the same? You're asking whether it is the same crime in law and in fact. but it is essentially application of the Blockberger test. So it's called differently, but the looking at the elements and that kind of finding something that's not in the other is essentially the Blockberger test. So you look at that, and there is an element that is in each, that is in robbery that is not in the assault, and one that is in assault that's not in the robbery. You have an intent to steal or to commit a theft in the robbery, which is not an element of assault in the third degree. In the assault in the third degree, you have the intent to avoid lawful apprehension or detention, which is not an element in the robbery. I would also submit to you that the force used in the robbery may be an assault, but it doesn't have to be an assault. It's the use of force or the threatened use of force. So if you go into a bank and you pass up a note that says, give me all the money, you know, or I'm going to shoot, you have committed a robbery, but you have not yet assaulted that teller. So there are different elements here. You don't always prove an assault in the third degree when you prove a robbery, and you don't prove a robbery when you prove an assault in the third degree. Strong evidence that these are separate offenses that may be separately punished. The next thing you look at is the murder doctrine, if applicable. And here I take exception with him. We don't have a situation where the legislature has created a higher degree of crime by commission of a base offense plus the commission of another crime that is punished elsewhere. We're on
isn't that what assault three is? You take any assault on a certain enumerated person because of their status, you want to make it a felony. I mean, isn't that what it is? Because these were security officers.
Right, but it doesn't say an assault committed during the course of a robbery makes it assault in the third degree.
I see.
That's what I'm saying. The robbery is not, it's a robbery, it's a second degree robbery. It's the lowest form of robbery that there is. They haven't elevated it to the first degree by saying, oh, and if you assault the person who's trying to detain you, it's an assault in the first degree.
But for the assault, it would not be a robbery, would it?
You were talking about under the facts of this case?
Mm-hmm.
Well, under the facts, you need the use of force. Absolutely, you need that element of that. But I'm saying it doesn't have to be an assault to get you your force. That would be the robbery.
But in this case, it is the assault.
It is the swing and the miss. Right. There are multiple assaults here, and that's what we come to in the next portion of that. Is it the same under law? And it's not. It's also not the same under the facts of this case, because there were two assaults on this officer. The first one was a swing and the miss while he still had possession of the stolen liquor bottles. The second one was a swing and a hit, which he did after he had lost possession of the liquor bottles. And under Johnson, that force cannot be used. You cannot consider that second swing and the hit for the robbery because he no longer had possession.
But Johnson is a little different. I mean, Johnson, the person clearly gave it up and voluntarily relinquished the property. It was no longer an issue about whether or not he was trying to retain the property. Here, it's a little more cloudy, isn't it?
All you know is that the bottles fell out. He did not testify. The defendant did not testify. So all we know is that he no longer had possession of the bottles when he took that. How do you know that he wasn't holding those with his arm and purposely dropped them at the point because he wanted to have use of his arm? So he said, I got to get rid of this because I can't hold on to this. And, you know.
I thought they were in his pants, were they not?
They're in his pants.
That's what the evidence was.
Well, the evidence was they were tucked into, he was wearing baggy clothing and they were tucked into his pants. Whether his pants could stay up holding up two bottles of liquor, I don't know. You know, there's no evidence about that one way or the other.
What happens to the transactional theory of robbery if the bottles slip out, he picks them back up? They slip out, they picks them back up. One slips out, he picks it back up while there's an ongoing scuffle.
Then the argument would be that it's still part of the same robbery because the force that he's using that, he's still trying to retain possession of that, and any force he uses in that could be used to be saying he's trying to obtain or retain it. You have no evidence that he was ever trying to reobtain the bottles after they slipped out of his pants.
So if they slip out, he hits somebody, then he picks them back up. While he didn't have the bottles, that's still part of the robbery?
Then you would be arguing that he was using the force to order to prevent, you know, them from stopping him from taking the things.
It's his intent, whether he intended to abandon or not, that makes a difference.
Right. Well, that force, what I'm saying is that force could be considered as part of the robbery. That doesn't get you around the fact that you still might be able to punish him for both the robbery and the assault, as in Cali. Cali, they had two punishments for a single act of intercourse. They had it under the rape statutes and they had it under the incest. So this whole, it's commonly said you can't punish somebody twice for the same act. That's not technically true. As long as you do it in a single prosecution and the legislature has allowed for multiple punishments, you can do it. So, you know, that's one of the things that the court looks at. I agree with you that if you have this kind of trying to get the property back and get away, you have an argument that you still have an ongoing transactional theory of robbery. That doesn't really answer the question about whether you can still prosecute on an assault in the third degree within that. There, I would say, I would argue you could still have both convictions, but they would probably be the same criminal conduct because they would be same time, same place, and serve the same they would have the same kind of intent going on at the same time.
How do you distinguish Butler?
Well, Butler is an old case, and if you go through and read it, it simply cannot hold up after Cali and Michelli. Butler talks about that we didn't even have the right to bring those cases, to file those cases. That's not true. Under Michelli, they said double jeopardy, the state can file whatever it wants. You work this out at sentencing. But, again, it comes back to the concept, and I think an old-fashioned one, that, again, it's looking at you can't punish somebody twice for the same act. And after Cali, that's not true. It's clear that this is a legislative intent issue, and it's did the legislature authorize multiple punishments. And well, so its analysis simply doesn't hold up after those cases.
Change the facts in this a little bit. What if there wasn't two security guards, it was just one security officer, and it was the same assault that is counted to elevate it to assault three and make it robbery? Is that permissible? Could you have double convictions for that?
Yes, because they're still separate offenses, right? Because each has an element, the other one does not. But they would definitely, under that circumstance, be the same criminal conduct. They could both appear on the judgment. Neither could be used to increase the offender score of the other, and the terms would have to run concurrent.
So they wouldn't be punished twice?
They would not.
Except for the collateral consequences.
Right, which is what happened in Cali. They were both on the judgment. That neither was used to increase the offender score, and the terms were run concurrently. So again, I think if you look at the four-part test, and again, the other thing I would say about Butler and the merger test, he talks about the merger test was used there. But that's looking at what the court did. This is looking at what the legislature does. The legislature has not said, we're going to make a higher degree crime here by the commission of a base crime plus the commission of another crime. You're really looking at what the legislature statutes that the legislature passed, not otherwise.
But the legislature hadn't said anything about this, has it?
Well, they enacted these crimes. And in enacting these crimes, they said that the force that you used in your robbery has to be to obtain or retain possession of the property stolen. They made that an element of the crime. When they enacted assault in the third degree, they said it's if you're trying to avoid lawful apprehension or detention. They didn't say anything about it that it had to be in the course of a robbery during that point in time.
So just by the separate by enacting separate statutes,
sure,
we are to take that as an inference.
That's right.
From and the legislative intent that they be punished separately.
Which they did in Cali. They said, look, one of these is under family offenses. The incest laws is under this portion of the RCW. We look at the rape ones. They're under sexual offenses. They're in completely different portions, you know, of the criminal codes. That is an indication that they intended separate punishments as well. So my time is about out. If there's no other questions, I again would ask you to affirm the convictions and sentence below.
Judge Tricky, I agree with Ms. Proctor's answer in terms of the same evidence in Blockberger. I'm not aware of a distinction in terms of how they work, but let me explain why the Blockberger analysis doesn't matter here, because the state has certainly chosen to focus on it, and I think State v. Freeman is the case that really shows why it doesn't matter. In Freeman, there were two defendants involved. One was charged with assault two and rob one, the other one assault one and rob one. In that case, neither defendant made any attempt to show that under Blockberger the legislature intended the two crimes to be treated as one. And the reason that attempt was not made is because it appeared, when you lined up the elements, that each had an element that the other one did not. So under Blockberger, it did not show that the legislature intended one conviction. It wasn't until you looked at the merger analysis that, in fact, the legislative intent was revealed as to those two sets of crimes. And if you look at the Freeman decision, Justice Chambers in that decision says, you know, the parties are not arguing that this meets Blogberger, so we're not going to even, you know, attempt to do the analysis. They went straight on to merger. So even in a situation where Blogberger might have one outcome, if merger analysis shows that the legislature only intended one crime, then one crime is what the defendant gets.
So what's the legislative intent here, then, comparing these two statutes?
The legislative intent here under merger analysis is that there be one conviction. You know, Ms. Proctor's talking about Cali and sex offenses. Sex offenses are one thing. We have a long line of cases discussed in Freeman here in Washington dealing with assault and robbery and how they interact, and a long history of only allowing, under most circumstances, one conviction. That's the conviction for robbery, where the assault provides the force that elevates the crime from theft to robbery. So I don't think Cali really gives us any indication of what the legislature intended. In Freeman, the state asked the court to overrule these long line of cases, and the court refused to do so, saying we think it's consistent with a case-by-case analysis. And I think it shows the intent in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.